You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. In Garibaldi, port leaders say boats run aground in a federal channel on an almost daily basis, and at low tide, boats rest on the bottom in the boat basin. Now the port is gearing up for dredging in both areas. For Oregon ports, regular removal of sediment from channels and boat basins is key to their operations. But they're struggling with dredging as costs soar. Local port managers also point to the permitting process. Mike Saint-Don, the port manager for the Port of Garibaldi, says they had to undergo review by a laundry list of state and federal agencies to try to land their required 10-year permits. Initially, dredging was planned for last year, but the port missed their window for the work when a needed sediment reevaluation was not completed in time. With no new permit forthcoming, the Port of Garibaldi pushed to begin the project in September before the current permit expires. Dredging is set to begin next week on a federal channel at Garibaldi and will be conducted by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Dredging in the boat basin will follow in September. The port will use a state-owned dredging barge for that work. The boat basin was last dredged in 2016. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. A recently released single-day count of homeless individuals in Clatsop County shows a drop compared to last year. Clatsop Community Action's point-in-time count in January recorded 944 individuals. In 2025, that number was over 1,200. The per capita rate of people experiencing homelessness in Clatsop County remains much higher than Oregon's average per capita rate, but accurately counting this population can be difficult because of the variety of living situations Clatsop Community Action tracks. Viviana Matthews, executive director at Clatsop Community Action, says January's point-in-time count is just a snapshot. It does not represent everyone who experiences homelessness throughout the year. She says the reason for this year's lower count could be due to any number of factors. A new commission has been added to Astoria's government. This week, the Astoria City Council approved the creation of the Arts and Culture Commission. The commission is the city's 10th advisory board. City leaders say the primary purpose of the commission will be to advise the city council about arts and culture policy and serve as the city's liaison to the arts and culture community. The commission will consist of 5 members who will vote on things related to the administration of certain arts and culture programs, projects, and initiatives. The commissioners will be appointed by the mayor. All members of the commission will serve staggered 3-year terms. Commissioners will likely be appointed before the end of the year. The Arts and Culture Commission's first year of service begins in 2027. These stories come to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyhistorian.com.
A former manager of several Long Beach businesses is facing felony charges following an investigation into alleged theft of more than $180,000. Leancy Anderson managed several vacation rental properties, as well as Long Beach Amusements, Castaways, and Storm and Norman's. Anderson is accused of orchestrating a multi-year embezzlement scheme that targeted these businesses she was entrusted in running. The alleged embezzlement came to light after Anderson's former employer found accounts rapidly depleted and regular bills going unpaid in late 2025. Search warrants executed in May yielded over 1,000 pages of bank records matching the unauthorized transactions, with discrepancies dating back to 2022. Anderson will make her first appearance in court August 28th. She faces 2 counts of first-degree theft with aggravating factors, 2 counts of first-degree theft, and 1 count of second-degree theft. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Daily Astorian, online at dailyhistorian.com.
You're listening to KMUN, turning now to news out of Washington State. The Trump administration has submitted its plan to end protections on 44 million acres of pristine land in national forests. The USDA says the so-called roadless rule has prevented much-needed thinning and wildfire reduction work. More from KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe.
In the late 1990s, a massive backlog on forest road maintenance and decades of gridlock over industrial logging set the tone for the roadless rule. President Bill Clinton enacted it in 2001. It protects about a third of the national forest land in the U.S. Roughly 2 million acres of that are in Washington. Now the USDA calls that policy a failure and says lifting the rule will provide better access for much-needed thinning and restoration work to protect forest health and prevent wildfires. Environmentalists say more roads will lead to more fires because the vast majority are sparked by human activity, and they're worried about harms to wildlife habitat and clean drinking water. Multiple advocacy groups are expected to sue to block the repeal. The proposal is open for public comments till September 21st. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
Democratic Washington Governor Bob Ferguson and Republican U.S. Congressman Michael Baumgartner, who represents Eastern Washington, are asking for a meeting with President Donald Trump. The request comes as the state deals with one of its worst fire seasons on record. In a letter to the president, Ferguson and Baumgartner say they will soon be requesting a major disaster declaration to assist thousands of people in Spokane and other parts of the state. The letter says many of these individuals have lost everything. In Spokane, more than 800 structures have been destroyed. Ferguson and Baumgartner say they want to share information directly with Trump and answer any questions he might have. Trump has already approved emergency funding for Eastern Washington wildfires. If the emergency disaster declaration is approved, it would unlock federal dollars for more long-term recovery efforts for things such as rebuilding homes and medical expenses. The Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Ecology are working their way through the neighborhoods that have burned in the Spokane complex fires. SPR's Lisa Leinberger reports on what crews may find.
For the next 60 days, crews will clean up hazardous household waste. Spokane Regional Health District has issued a public health order that says homeowners shouldn't rebuild before materials have been removed. EPA Incident Commander Brooke Stanfield says the crews may not only find toxic materials, but things that explode.
Ammunition that hasn't been discharged. And so we will sweep that up, or if it's too big for our crews, which is, you know, usually like 50 caliber or larger, we'll call in the bomb squad.
The hazmat teams will also find intact firearms. Stanfield says that when they find these, they turn them over to the sheriff's office to get them back to the owner. While teams are cleaning up these materials, Stanfield wants residents to know that they don't have to worry about cleaning up anything hazardous. I'm Lisa Leinberger.
In Washington state, climate change is expected to bring lower stream flows, warmer winter temperatures, and less snowpack in lower elevations. That's according to a presentation from the state's climatologist. NWPB senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt has more.
It's not often that you get a peek into the future, but climate scientists say Washington State glimpsed into the crystal ball in 2015 with its lowest snowpack on record. Guillaume Mogier is Washington's state climatologist. At the Northwest Power and Conservation Council's August meeting, he said conditions in 2015 led to hundreds of thousands of fewer sockeye, major crops with poor yields, and millions spent on fire suppression.
From like a weather nerd perspective, it was something I never expected to see in my lifetime.
Mogier says he expects those conditions to be normal by the 2070s or 2080s. This year, he says it's highly likely the region will experience a very strong El Niño. Mogier says there isn't much data for this strong of an El Niño, but in the Northwest, El Niños often mean higher winter temperatures and less snowfall. I'm Courtney Flatt.
Mayor Wilson is facing increased pressure about police cameras. She turned off some. Hundreds are still active. KUOW's Scott Greenstone has the latest.
A poll released Monday of 500 Seattleites showed broad support for a citywide system of police cameras. But the poll was commissioned by Seattle's Chamber of Commerce, and anti-surveillance activists said the questions were leading at a City Hall rally.
If you tell people that the only answer is cameras to public safety, like questions in this poll disingenuously did, then they're going to say we want public safety.
Leah Salerno is an attorney and organizer. She was joined by members of Seattle Indivisible and other groups. She just toured what police call the Real-Time Crime Center, which integrates all the video from hundreds of public and private cameras. Activists are lobbying the mayor to turn off all the cameras. Wilson is waiting on an audit expected this fall. I'm Scott Greenstone in Seattle.
Turning now to news from across Oregon. The Oregon Department of Transportation received a federal grant to create and restore pollinator habitat along Oregon highways. Jefferson Public Radio's Peyton Gast explains there are conflicted feelings from Rogue Valley pollinator advocates.
The nationwide roadside pollinator program is giving Oregon the maximum amount, $150,000. Christina Lefevre with Pollinator Project Rogue Valley says the roadside initiative is great for spreading awareness, but she says there are better ways to spend that money.
I wish we had $150,000 in federal funds to help people plant pollinator gardens and appreciate how they look in other places of the Rogue Valley.
Lefevre says the best place for pollinator gardens are in city parks or other local spaces where people can easily take care of them. Oregon Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley announced the grant. In the statement, they said pollinator habitats along highways are a better alternative to barren roadsides. In Ashland, I'm Peyton Gast.
The University of Oregon is offering more details about how it plans to cut $65 million from its budget as it weathers declining out-of-state enrollment and other trends impacting higher education. In a briefing for reporters Tuesday, UO Provost Chris Long said a committee representing a variety of disciplines will review enrollment, outcomes, and other data from academic programs. He said numbers alone will not determine what's under consideration for cuts.
We're not going to just set targets from a data standpoint. We're going to have to look at this holistically. As I said, we have to deliver on a broad liberal arts education. That means we're going to have to continue to teach a wide variety of things.
Long said the committee's work is confidential right now, but a budget proposal will be released and available for public feedback in October. Final decisions will be made in December. Budget officials said they could not release specific programs facing cuts yet, but some reductions may roll out over several years. In Oregon, a Bend child care center that closed abruptly in July will open its doors again soon, under a plan Oregon State University Cascades announced Tuesday. Catherine Steyer Martinez reports.
After 2 months, the former Little Kits building will once again host over two dozen children. Neighbor Impact, a nonprofit service provider, will open the program September 8th. It's leasing three classrooms from OSU Cascades at below market rent. Neighbor Impact Executive Director Scott Cooper says Head Start is part of the solution to the childcare affordability and availability issues in Central Oregon. At a press conference, he said the program is still a work in progress.
It's going to take all of us as a community of both higher education and service providers and the private sector figuring out a way to solve this unsolvable problem.
Cooper says six of the 33 spots will be set aside for kids two and younger, and some childcare spots will be made available for families making over the Head Start income limit. I'm Catherine Steyer Martinez, reporting.
New types of war are forcing the military to supply troops with new types of meals. Jay Price of the American Homefront Project visited some soldiers as they tried the latest approach to feeding troops in combat.
On the front lines of World War II, there were the famous canned sea rations with main courses like meat and vegetable stew and cans of dense crackers. In recent wars, there were the meals ready to eat, or MREs, with components packed into a tough plastic pouch and years of shelf life. Those are still widely used, but now...
That's actually really good.
Yeah.
A new ration designed for modern battlefields is starting to reach some units.
Very good.
Have you tried this?
That's a squad of special operations soldiers trying the new close combat assault ration, which, like all things military, has an acronym, CCAR. They're taking a break in the middle of a pine forest at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, after a humid 8-hour slog testing their land navigation skills. And they're happy to get time to eat before their next task.
That might be one of the best snacks I've had.
The new rations are designed for conflicts in which getting supplies to small, widely dispersed units is made harder by tech-savvy opponents, like the current drone-infested front lines of the war in Ukraine, or fighting China across island chains in the Pacific. That kind of combat could mean going days without a chance for resupply, so making food lighter and smaller is crucial. Aaron Gaffney-Stomberg leads the Combat Feeding Division at DEVCOM Soldier Center in Natick, Massachusetts, which develops rations for all the services.
The ration platforms that were available were too large to meet that need. And so this development really came from that shift in defense strategy and the requirements that the user community had for the future.
The CCAR is the replacement for what's called the first strike ration, which was designed for short missions lasting no more than 72 hours. 5 days of the new rations has the same volume as 3 days of first strikes. Gaffney-Stomberg said testing shows troops tend to take in more calories with the CCARs, which helps them perform better in missions that burn a lot of energy. That's partly because of the CCAR's fat levels and partly about their taste.
The warfighters did prefer some of the components or individual food items that were in the close combat assault ration compared to the first strike ration.
The latest science on sports nutrition was a starting point, but she said the Army had to go deeper, looking at differences in dietary needs between athletes and troops in combat who are more likely to have additional stressors like sleep deprivation and chaotic environments. And it all had to be done in a way that made the CCAR palatable, because nutritional content doesn't matter if the troops aren't eating it. An informal sampling of the soldiers in the woods at Fort Bragg suggests it hits that goal.
I thought the burrito bowl was a lot better quality.
That's Nick, a sergeant who, because of his unit, can only be identified by his first name. He especially likes that the CCAR includes a lot of small components, like bars and packets of trail mix.
So that way, when you're moving through the field, you can pull those out and kind of keep them in a pocket, so it's easier nutrition, per se.
Some in the group said they wished for less sugar, but a sergeant named Alexa said after her hard efforts that morning, the recipes seemed about right.
I needed the sugar that has a lot of calories for days like this.
So what did you eat so far?
I ate the trail mix and the almond coconut nut bar. I also ate the cookie, oatmeal cookie.
As small and light as the CCAR is, the Army experts aren't done with trying to improve future field rations. Lately, they've been working with a production method called vacuum microwave drying. One result is a rectangle of compressed vegetables infused with honey mustard dressing that's been dubbed the salad bar. I'm Jay Price reporting.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have updates from Kansas and North Carolina today. August 4th, Kansas voters rejected a measure to elect state Supreme Court justices. And August 17th, North Carolina's governor vetoed an anti-voter bill which would have shortened early primary voting, among other restrictions. The Kansas Reflector reports that the Republican supermajorities in the House and Senate had hoped a smaller turnout of GOP faithful might support a long-sought measure to elect, rather than nominate, state Supreme Court justices. It didn't work, with 61% of voters rejecting the measure. Kansas will continue to use an independent, merit-based process which nominates 3 qualified candidates from which the governor may choose. Voters enshrined the process in the Constitution after a 1956 scandal in which a lame duck governor resigned and was immediately appointed as a justice by his successor. We reported August 7th that an anti-voter bill passed by the North Carolina legislature might be vetoed by Governor Josh Stein. August 17th, Stein vetoed House Bill 958, which would have shortened early primary voting from 17 days to 10, expanded the window during which voter eligibility could be challenged, and directed the state election board to use the notoriously inaccurate SAVE database for voter roll maintenance. A veto override is unlikely. We've linked to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.